Yes, sir.
May it please the Court, Mark Colley for CGI Federal, member of the Virginia Bar. I'm introducing Mr. David Weiner, who's been admitted pro hack, and will make the oral argument.
All right. Mr. Weiner, where are you from?
Washington, D.C., the
well,
D.C.
That
bar.
That wasn't too far, was it?
Not too bad today. Windy day.
Glad to have you.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Your Honor. The issue before you in this case is whether CGI will have a remedy for what a jury found was a fraud and breach of contract by the defendant, FCI. The Circuit Court threw out the jury verdict and then granted summary judgment without any explanation on CGI's unjust enrichment claim. If the Circuit Court's decision stands, then CGI will be left without a remedy, and FCI will face no consequences for its fraudulent conduct, and indeed will be allowed to have profited from its scheme to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. This is not the right outcome under Virginia law.
But that's sometimes what happens when you have a breach and causation and no damages. Or you have a promissory fraud and you bring a benefit of the bargain analysis and it doesn't get you far enough.
Sure.
So it's not a failure of moral principles of tort law or contract law. It's a failure of proof.
So, Your Honor, why don't I start off on the fraud claim? There's a lot, obviously, in your question, but I'll start there. And I think there's really one key issue that resolves both your question and essentially all of the arguments as far as fraud goes in this case, and that is this. The fraud at issue here is not about performance or promises under the amended teaming agreement. The fraud in this case is about a misrepresentation of present intent that occurred when FCI promised to give CGI 41% work share and 10 management positions in order to induce it to continue teaming with it. And that fraudulent promise, Your Honor, that occurred before the parties entered into the amended teaming agreement. That's what distinguishes this case from, I suspect, one of the cases that you have in mind, like Dunn. That was a situation, Your Honor, where the fraudulent promise, the promissory fraud, was directly about a contractual obligation. The defendant there said, we have a contract, I have to build this retaining wall in workmanlike condition. But he was lying, and he lied to the plaintiff, said, I built the wall, it's fine, it's good to go. But he was lying. The lie was purely about an existing contractual obligation. The fraud in this case, the easiest way to think about it, I think, is on April 17th, when this false promise is made to give CGI 41% work share. Where is that contractual obligation? We should be able to look at an existing contract on April 17th where FCI has that obligation. It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist because the amended teaming agreement isn't executed until several days later. The fraud here is that misrepresentation of present intent to give us that work share that occurs before the amended teaming agreement is ever executed.
How would you prove your damages, even if that were true, if the evidence is that they wouldn't have gotten the contract if they had given you the 41% that you're saying you were entitled to?
So if FCI wouldn't have gotten the contract?
Correct.
So I think it would be up to, it's a jury question ultimately, Your Honor, what we proved, and I think it goes back to what is the false promise. That is the benchmark for determining fraudulent inducement damages. What is the false promise that the defendant makes to induce our conduct? And what?
Well, the promise determines whether or not there's a breach. The question I have is, what are the damages from the breach?
Right. Well, so the damages are, and this is what the jury found. This is the jury was instructed, and these instructions are not disputed on appeal, is that we were entitled to the losses sustained as well as the gains prevented as a natural consequence of the fraud. And so what we demonstrated is that if we had actually gotten 41% work share as we had been promised, the promise that induced us, then what would have happened? We would have earned if we had gotten 41%, we would have earned a profit of $8.5 million in damages.
But how do you respond to the trial judge who hears all that and says, no, the deal, the promise was I'll give you 41%, and the bargain was we're going to work together and try to get the subcontract? It wasn't, I'm promising you I will get the subcontract, and I'm promising you that I'm going to give you 41% of it. It was rather, I'm promising you, we're going to work towards getting the contract together, but we don't know if we'll get it or not, and we'll work towards you getting 41%. And so, since you didn't put on a damage model for that latter scenario,
right?
You put on a damage model as if it were a breach of the subcontract deal to get 41% of all of the subcontract stream of revenue. That's a long way off of promissory fraud.
So, Your Honor, I don't think it is, and there's a couple reasons for it. And I think that the question that you pose and what the circuit court did was effectively to take the fraud and the contract claims and mix them back together again. And I don't think that's how this court has ever approached fraudulent inducement damages. You think about the so first of all, the fraud here, Your Honor, I understand what you're saying. That
it's promissory fraud. I mean, I'm wondering if you're blurring that line. It's not actual fraud in the pristine sense. It's making a future promise that you have no present intent to do. That's a very unique, you know, genre
right,
of fraud.
But Your Honor, the fraud here, the false promise was not we're going to give you 41% work share, but only for the first 90 days. That's not what they were promising us.
I thought the promise was we're going to try to work towards getting you 41% and we're going to try to get this subcontract.
Your Honor, I would encourage you to look at the email at issue here. This is the April 17th email. It's in the JA 3027. And it's as clear-cut a case of fraud as I think this court probably has ever seen. And what happened is...
But that's accepted. I mean, there's no question you proved your fraud. I mean, they told you a flat-out lie, and there was ample evidence to support the jury verdict on that. The problem is, they've got to get the contract, and then you got to sit down and haggle over the 41%, which 10 management positions, what kind of 41% work, and then there's this intervening act where the contract negotiations fall apart. That's the hang-up and the difficulty.
Right, but I think there are two points here, Your Honor. One is that they did get the contract, number one.
Right.
That happened. Number two is that part of the factual case about the fraud was that when they were telling us we're going to give you 41%, behind our backs they were actually proposing
right.
us to the government at much less than that. So
right.
So it seems to put us in an unusual position. It would seem to be a very strange rule that really lets the fraudster off the hook and incentivizes
but
the fraud.
But what's unusual about saying you got to prove your damages? So suppose I just flat out lie to you and I have a flood damaged car and I say, all right, you know, it's gently used, but you have to go out and get your own financing. I've just bald-faced lied to you. And then for whatever reason, the banks turn you down on, and so you can't get a car loan. You can't buy the car. So I lied to you, but you don't have any damages because the car... How is this...
Number one, the jury was presented with these types of arguments, and the jury disagreed. The damages model, Your Honors, was that if we had 41% work share, we would get $8.5 million in damages. And that assumed, and that was presented over the 5 years of the contract.
But wouldn't that depend on you agreeing in this 90-day window to a contract?
The only reason, Your Honor, that we didn't come to a conclusion on the contract is because we were never offered the 41%. Immediately off the bat, when we start, after the prime contract is awarded to FCI, the starting point for negotiations from FCI was, here's 17%. So, it seems to reward FCI for having committed this really brazen fraud. And I would just refer you back to this court's decision in the White Sewing Machine. It's an old case, 1921, and that was a case where they had a claim for lost profits based on a fraudulent inducement. And the measure of damages that this court said is put the defrauded party in the position it would have been in if the false promise had been true. Now, as a factual matter in that case...
Well, think where that takes you, though. That just means the induced contract is the teaming agreement. It's obviously not the subcontract because that didn't exist. How can they have a present tense?
It didn't exist because of the fraud, Your Honor. Exist because they defrauded us, because they were committing fraud. They never gave us 41%. If after the prime had been awarded to FCI and they said, guess what, here is a subcontract with 41%, we would be fine. We would have had a subcontract.
Was 41% the only element of the contract to be negotiated, or were there other aspects of the contract to be negotiated?
So there were the way that the teaming agreement was written is that there were provisions that could not be renegotiated. These are the provisions in Exhibit A to the amended teaming agreement.
Were there other aspects of the contract other than the 41% that still needed to be negotiated.
Yes. So then,
and so how do we know, how would this jury know, that other aspects of the contract would not have been, you would not have been able to reach agreement on those as well? Your argument sounds as if the only aspect was the 41%. We had agreed on that. They didn't give us the 41%. Contract fell through. We get our fraud damages. But if there are other aspects to be negotiated, then how? What is the proof that you still would have reached contract?
So I think two responses. Number one is that I don't think that that is our burden in the fraudulent inducement case to prove that counterfactual for a couple of reasons. Number one is that I do think that that mixes the contract and the fraud claim, and that departs from how this court has evaluated fraudulent inducement damages by looking at the value of the promise or what our damages would have been if the promise had been true. That's what the court did
but
in White Zone.
Again, we're circling around so much here. The promise here is we're going to work together to get this prime, and then we're going to try to reach a deal on the subcontract. But there's no contractual right to the subcontract. You got 90 days, and if you don't reach a deal, everybody walks.
Right, and that. But the reason that it fell apart is because we never got the 41%. That was never on offer. I mean,
Does the record establish that was not the reason?
I'm sorry?
Does the record establish that was not the reason? So in other words, if they come in and they say, I mean, because there was this protracted period of negotiation, so it would seem like under your theory the negotiations would have failed at the outset.
Your Honor, the reason that it didn't fail at the outset is precisely because of the fraud. We were in a situation where we had committed all of this effort to secure this agreement. We told them, we can only go forward on this with you if you're going to give us 41% work share. They promise that's what you're going to get. They're lying about it. We find out about it after the fact, and we're in this impossible situation where if we want to get anything out of this, all of these sunk costs, we have no choice. We have to accept.
That's a function of the teaming agreement. You agreed that you basically don't have a contractual right to get anything in the end, but you agree to work together, and then you have a clause that says everyone's going to suck up their own sunk costs. So if you fraudulently induce someone into a contract that is unenforceable as an agreement to agree, isn't that a different scenario than the scenarios you've outlined in your brief?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because in terms of being induced into an unenforceable agreement, all of those cases just talk about whether or not it's reasonable to rely. And here, the false promise here, it was eminently reasonable for us to rely on a promise from FCI's own president telling us
I'm not implying you're wrong on that, but you get benefit of the bargain or you get rescission and restitution. You didn't ask for rescission and restitution because you didn't have any out-of-pocket losses you could recover that was worth worrying about. But you want benefit of the bargain not on the teaming agreement, but on a subcontract that never was agreed to.
Your Honor, it's based on the false promise that was made.
Well, do you have any cases where lost profits are actually recoverable that don't flow directly from an enforceable contract?
So, well, I don't know about directly from an unenforceable contract, Your Honor. I don't know that that precise scenario has been before this court. But in the fraudulent inducement context, this court has numerous cases saying that the measure of damages for fraudulent inducement is the value of the promise if it had been true, which makes perfect sense. And remember, the promise here was we will give you 41% if we get the prime award.
And
they got the prime
award. And if we agree on a subcontract. You keep leaving that last step out. That was the whole ruling of the trial court.
But, Your Honor, they got the prime award. And if we had an offer of 41%, we would have had a work share. That was, from our end, that was agreed.
But not from their end.
No, if you would have had an offer of 41% and you had negotiated what was probably going to be a rather complex contract.
But, Your Honor, the testimony at trial was that all of the negotiations, the stumbling blocks were essentially all being resolved, and they finally collapsed when FCI's insistence was that we have a provision that allows us to unilaterally take away your work share.
Well, I'm not going to sit here and argue that FCI gets put up on a pedestal for their business practices. The issue is it was possible for parties to negotiate, whether in good faith, bad faith, or no faith at all, and not come to a contractual agreement. And if you don't come to a contractual agreement, for whatever reason, how can you possibly measure the damages?
As this Court has said, Your Honor, it's measured by the value of the promise. And
the value of the promise was that you were going to be able to get to step two in order to try to negotiate a contract.
And we got to step two. We made it there. And they never offered 41%.
You
and so you're forcing us to prove a counterfactual that we can't prove because of their fraud.
Is there testimony that we had negotiated every aspect of this contract except the 41%, and we got to the 41% and they offered 7%?
No, so, Your Honor, right out of the gate, and I apologize, Your Honor,
but
I can give a brief answer. Your Honor, immediately after the prime was awarded and negotiations started for the subcontract, FCI said, you're not getting 41%, here's 17% work share. We negotiated, we got up to about 22%, and FCI said, that's it, you're not getting anything else. So that, I mean, again, you're forcing us to be in a situation where we can't prove this counterfactual because of the fraud that they committed, which seems like a very unusual rule, especially in a circumstance where you've got these teaming agreements, which are essential to government contractors, and it's really going to be open season in these types of relationships because you're saying there's not a contract remedy, then there's no fraud remedy. At the very least, there should be fraud. There probably also has to be unjust enrichment as well. We have an unexplained summary judgment order on unjust enrichment. And so at the very least, if the contract is unenforceable, and especially if you're saying there's no fraud remedy, then there must be unjust enrichment. Or, I mean, government contractors are going to be in a real bind in Virginia, which is a critical industry in the Commonwealth.
Why would they get out of that bond by entering an enforceable contract?
I'm sorry?
Why wouldn't they get out of that bond by entering an enforceable contract as opposed to an unenforceable
contract? Well, the question then, Your Honor, is how do you have a teaming agreement that is enforceable? If you look at what FCI is saying and what the Circuit Court said, the effect of those arguments is that teaming agreements are not going to be enforceable under Virginia law. And our position is that that's not what this Court has ever said. That's not the approach that you took in Navarre and Schaefer. So there's got to be some rules in this game, some rules in this industry. We did everything proper, we think, on our end. And at every turn, FCI weren't playing fair. And we've got to have some remedy. If you're saying it's not contract, we do think that there's an independent fraud claim. If you think that there's not fraud, There's got to be something. At the very least, there's got to be unjust enrichment because if we don't have any of those remedies, it is going to be the Wild West in this industry. And you're going to be seeing a lot of cases that are at least as bad as this because there will be no rules in effect whatsoever. And it's going to have a serious impact not just on state government contracting but on federal government contracting as well, all of whom rely on the ability for parties to team together.
Your time has expired.
Thank you
very much. Ms. Mundy.
May it please the Court, good morning. Monica Mundy on behalf of FCI. I'd first like to thank the Court and my opposing counsel for their courtesy shown to me due to my illness yesterday, and thank you for changing the schedule.
Court thanks you as well.
Thank you. The breach of contract and the fraud claims fail for the very same reason. CGI did not prove any damages caused by fraud or breach.
Can you help me with that? Because I just heard your opposing counsel argue that the reason the negotiations failed was because of this percentage business. So it's one thing, let's say they just can't agree to which 10 management position. You know, they want these, we want to give them those, and that's why it fails, or some other reason. We can't agree on an hourly rate or something like that. Their argument is factually the record supports that we went into it with 41%, the client would agree to a max 22%, so that's why the negotiations fail. And that may be a different argument than failure for a different reason. Can you help me with that point?
Absolutely. The argument that the subcontract didn't exist because of the fraud was not a theory that was pursued at trial. They never CGI did not pursue a claim that the failure to enter into the subcontract was either a breach or fraud. They just did not pursue it. Rather, it was our damages are fixed at a moment in time in April when the email was sent. So this
if that had happened, would that be, because as the Chief pointed out in an earlier argument, we have to look at cases down the line. So suppose that had been the situation where, you know, this is our teaming agreement, 41%, 10 management positions, and maybe the other side is, we get to that point, they're maybe negotiating in bad faith, or the stumbling block is that very thing that was agreed to. Would that be a viable, hypothetically, I'm not asking you to concede it's this case, but would that be hypothetically a viable damages theory?
Yes, theoretically. If you can prove the nexus between the fraud and the damages, then you could have pursued that. So, for example, hypothetically, if the parties had, in fact, reached an agreement on a subcontract where perhaps it was 22% work share for CGI, CGI might then have a claim for the difference between the 22% and the 41% if it could still prove that causal nexus between the absence of the 41 and what it actually got. It's a complete failure of proof on damages, because what they're trying to do is to read out of the party's whole understanding the fact that there had to be a subcontract. The only way that they could get paid is if there was a subcontract, and nothing in this lawsuit had anything to do with the fact that there wasn't a subcontract. The subcontract was never executed for reasons completely unrelated to the fraud or to the breach, something which they do not.
Could your client have entered into a subcontract of 41% based upon the facts as pled and given?
I believe so, Your Honor, or to maybe state it a little bit differently. The way that the 41% was set up in the teaming agreement was the parties still had to negotiate for that term. It was expressly subject to the parties reaching agreement, and this brings in Justice Powell's question about the other terms they had to agree to. It was subject to their mutual agreement on the statement of work. I mean, that's the statement of the work. Also financial terms and other reasonable subcontract provisions.
Tell me if I'm wrong, but as I read the record that's before us, it appeared that your client had essentially bargained away or promised away the ability to get up to 41%. Have I read that wrong?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, let's go to the.
You've got another dance partner that has to get a certain amount, and that has been represented to the contracting agency. How can you get up to 41%? I'm just a little slow here, I think.
Well, Your Honor, the way the whole teaming agreement works is that it's all going to be subject to the approval of the government, of a prime contract, and all of that.
But I'm saying hypothetically, how do you get up, on these facts, how do you get up to 41%? How are you capable of keeping the promise that has been made?
Because as the evidence was at trial, was that FCI had intended that because the scope of the work, that they were going to be able to substantially meet that, which is what the teaming agreement says. They'd be able to substantially meet it. But it doesn't change the fact that CGI elected not to sue for the failure to enter into the subcontract. They did not. That has nothing to do with the case. The 90 days ran for reasons unrelated to the fraud or any breach. That is the undisputed record.
So the inducement, the fraud in the inducement, is the inducement of the teaming agreement, which is we'll team together and try to get a prime, and if we get a prime, then we'll talk about the sub.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And one of the points, too, is that at JA 3027, which is the email does not say you get 41% if we win the prime contract. It did not alter the fundamental understanding that the parties had that there still needed to be a subcontract. So that's not what, and on brief, CGI indicates several times, oh, well, the email said you'd get 41% if we won the prime contract. That's not what it says.
Well, instead of lost profits, do you think they would be entitled to costs and expenses incurred for performing that agreement?
No, Your Honor, because the agreement itself barred that. The agreement stated that the parties would have to bear their own costs and expenses for performance of the agreement.
But wouldn't that assume, though, that the other party's dealing in good faith? Right? So, I mean, if we're all negotiating in good faith, then, yeah, we're going to put in our mutual resources trying to get this contract. But if I'm being two-timed, then isn't that a problem? But I think more fundamentally, is that what they ask for? In other words, did they ask for, look, we put all this time into an effort into getting this contract, those are the damages we want. Did they ask for that?
Those damages, Your Honor, my understanding is that that's the $300,000 for the unjust enrichment claim. That's for the pre-award. Right. They're expressly barred by the pre-award provisions of the contract. And I think this is it.
Are you talking about Section 2.7?
Yes, exactly, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. That, and interestingly enough, that identical language appears in a number. I think both the Cyberlaw case and the Schaefer versus Cordon case. This is a very common provision in a teaming agreement. That basically bars that particular claim.
Well, what if they had opted to rescind the agreement based on fraud?
They opted not to rescind, Your Honor. If they had opted to rescind, then they would need to be put into the same or substantially same position that they had been in with or without the fraud or the breach. And
Counsel, I'm on page 3027 now. You just told me to go to 3027, which I had done previously, and I've just done it again, looking for that language that says this is all going to apply only if we enter into a contract. I'm not finding it.
No, Your Honor, sorry. My point on 3027 is what CGI is saying is that the promise that was made in that email was if we get the prime contract, you get 41%. They're trying to read out the subcontract requirement that's part of the understanding of the parties.
In addition, the agreement will reflect CGI's 41% total contract value work share.
And that we will amend the teaming agreement to reflect that.
No, I just read an entire sentence that comes at the end of a paragraph. He says, I will ensure that our revised teaming agreement with CGI affirms our commitment to CGI, providing 10 management supervisor positions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In addition, the agreement will reflect CGI's 41% total contract value work share. They could not give a 41% total value contract work share once they got the award from the government, could they?
Your Honor, I believe that they could the way that the teaming agreement was written, because it still had to be subject to the negotiation of the parties for reasonable contract terms and the statement of work. The statement
of
work.
But wouldn't they then be in breach with their other folks that they'd made promises to?
I mean, there's a fixed pie of work, and you can't have. Right.
Correct. And it's also subject to a host of other terms, including the fact that the government awards it in the first place, and you have a variety of other contingencies that are there. But it still contemplated that there had to be a subcontract. They did not introduce evidence showing a link at a trial. There was no evidence showing a link between the damages and the promise that was made. They did not. The only way that they could have gotten paid is through the subcontract. And that goes in part to the contract theory, which is what they had was an unenforceable agreement to agree. It was expressly subject to all of those contingencies happening.
Are you saying the totality of it was unenforceable or simply the 41%?
Correct, Your Honor. Correct. The post-award provision.
Okay. Because clearly the teaming agreements contain certain binding clauses, but then they contemplate future negotiations and agreements as well.
Correct.
Okay.
And on this, this court has held in Boisseau and in Golding and more recently in the Longview case that the subject to language evinces an intent by the parties not to be bound until there is a future contract. And that's exactly what we have here. But the teaming agreement just didn't contemplate a future formal agreement. It was actually dependent upon it by its own terms. And we don't even need to look further than the 90-day agreement, the 90-day term that was in the contract itself. It stated that the teaming agreement would expire 90 days after a prime contract was awarded if there was no subcontract. Well, if the parties had intended that the teaming agreement would govern their post-award conduct, then why would they agree that the teaming agreement itself would expire if they didn't have a contract? The entire agreement was dependent upon, the future conduct of the parties was dependent upon the execution of a future subcontract.
I wonder, based upon that observation, if we're not making this case too complicated, because there are two promises, really. There is, I promise I'll work with you, and we'll try to get this prime. And we may not. I promise that I'll work to get the prime and include you at 41%, and that was apparently a misrepresentation, clearly a misrepresentation. So how could anyone say, well, I'm entitled to 41% of whatever you get, when they had just been told, I'm not making any promise I'm actually going to make a subcontract with you. I'm just saying, if I do, that's what you'll get.
Exactly, Your Honor. I mean, at the core of this understanding between the parties was the fact that there had to be a subcontract to get paid. In fact, that's why they needed the letter subcontract, was because they got so far along. The contract was awarded. They got so far along. They had to start work right away. There was no way for CGI to even get paid under the teaming agreement as it stood without a subcontract. So what did they do? The parties said, well, we need to enter into a letter subcontract. And in fact, CGI received $2 million for work that it performed under the letter subcontract.
So in theory, during the 90 days, either side could walk for any reason, no reason, good reasons, bad reasons?
Correct, just as they have done in other cases.
Is there an obligation to negotiate in good faith in that scenario?
Your Honor, there is, but again, they haven't sued for that. I mean, if that was a theory that they could have pursued at trial. They did not pursue a theory that the failure to enter into the subcontract was a breach or fraud. They alleged instead that it occurred in April when the promise was made. And even...
But their argument, as I hear you arguing, as I hear him arguing, is, yes, we had an agreement to enter into a subcontract. They were going to give us 41%. Out of the gate, they could not, would not give us 41%, and it all fell apart there. And so it was the fraud on the part of your client that caused them not to enter into the subcontract. That's their argument. Why isn't that valid?
Because that
I
was...
I think that's their argument.
Your Honor, I don't believe that theory was pursued at trial. It simply was not, and they never proved a causal nexus between any breach or fraud and damages.
Well, did they have an agreement to enter into a subcontract? I thought the whole point of agreement to agree is they didn't have an agreement to enter into a subcontract.
They did not. Under the best circumstances on any day, with or without fraud and with or without breach, was the opportunity to negotiate for a subcontract. The parties did negotiate for a subcontract. They came close to reaching one, and then for reasons unrelated to the fraud or the breach, they were unable to do so and parted ways. Those are the undisputed facts in the case. And that's why this claim fails.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Call
you very
the
much.
Next case.